Hello and welcome, friends, to another podcast episode. Today, on your favorite Christian radio station, I have with me special guest, Brother Jake. My name is Brother Dylan, and we hope that you are ready for our very special heavenly Easter special.
Brother Dylan, grace and peace be with you.
And also with you.
Praise the Lord.
Praise be.
And hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Ha ha!
What's poppin', kiddos?
It is Easter. Almost Easter. God, I cannot wait. The thing that I do every day, every time we have Easter, every year that it comes around, is I find a photo of Ewan McGregor dressed up as Obi-Wan Kenobi, and I post that shit on my Facebook to catch all my churchy friends with a caption that says, give your life to him or believe in him. He is our only hope. And they always fall for it. Every single year.
Oh, yeah. I fucking love that, man. Mm-hmm. That's so good. Mm-hmm. 1 year, and luckily Snapchat has, like, the memories thing, so I get to keep reposting it. But 1 year, I had, like, a pack of peeps, and on Easter, I ate all of the peep except for the heads, and then I stacked them on little, big toothpicks, and I just had them arranged and said, Happy Easter, and it was just a picture of peep heads on pikes.
That's deeply disturbing.
Oh, yeah. That was years ago, but that totally tracks for my character arc.
WKRX, Greater Cincinnati, all the metal hits. Hail Satan. I'm feeling it.
Hell yeah.
I had a great day today.
Excellent. Tell us about it. Hit me with it.
Oh yeah, I went to, back when I first bought my bike, I had registered for the Motorcycle Safety Foundation's Riding Academy, which teaches you all the basics of riding.
Couldn't tell.
Thanks. Don't be an asshole. But then I broke my leg on my bike because I was an inexperienced rider. And so one of the calls that I had to make the day after I broke my, you know, that morning after I broke my leg, because it happened, if you haven't listened already, it happened on a Wednesday night at about 9 o'clock. And so the girl I was dating at the time, Alex, drove me to the ER, and I found out that night that, yeah, my leg was broken, but I didn't get to see the orthopedic surgeon until the next day at 10 o'clock. And he came in and gave me the horrible news about, you know, that I had really broken my leg, and I was going to have surgery, and it was going to be 2 months before I could walk, 9 months before I could run, all this other stuff. And then I had to, I gave myself, like, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 2 minutes to feel sorry for myself.
Yeah.
And then I was like, hey, you just got to get this shit done. So I had to make all these phone calls. I had to call my boss and tell him the news. I call my dad, who chewed me out for 30 minutes. And mm-hmm. then my mom called me and said, your father's crying because of what happened to you. That made me feel even worse. I had to text my friends, who all made fun of me because they told me to be careful on my bike. Then I had to tell my brothers, too, and they got upset. And then I told my ex last. Yeah. What was going to happen? But anyway, one of the calls that I had to make was to the rider safety course, and they're like, "Oh, I'm really sorry that happened. The fee is non-refundable, so just let us know when you want to take the course." So I took the course today, and it was a lot of fun. Rode a small bike, a 500cc mm-hmm. Harley. First time I've ever been on a Harley. It's really low to the ground.
Yeah, I did really like, because I did the same Harley training course. I actually really enjoyed the bikes that they had set up for them. I thought they were super user-friendly, and it was just really easy to get a hold of. I've, you know, been around bikes forever, so I'm used mm-hmm. to bigger ones. It was weird being on, like, a small, very low to the ground bike, but it was really easy to learn on. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. The pegs and the controls are forward instead of mid, like my bike is. So yeah. that took a little bit of adjustment. But there's six of us in the class, and only two of us have ever been on a motorcycle before.
Oh, nice.
And so we're getting the least amount of scrutiny, for better or worse. But I mean, I'm catching on. At least I have some experience on it. Two people dropped their bikes today at a very low speed, so it was more like, I mean, it was nothing.
Nice.
And then one girl, what's funny is, come rain or shine, they're going to have you out there. So we got out there at 7 o'clock this morning. It was kind of chilly. It was very overcast. And then it started drizzling on us. Mm-hmm. We were out there for about 5 hours. Yeah. And it drizzled on us for about 4.5 hours. So we're kind of soaked. But we're having to do all of these low speed maneuvers and turning and cornering and all this other shit while the ground is, you know, damp and wet. And one girl just got freaked out and couldn't continue, and so she left.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Damn.
So she'll just have to come back and do it again, I think, or something. I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I have no idea what the case is for that. But I mean, we got lucky with ours because you know, ours, it was all sunny the whole time we were doing it, but it was really hot, so we were sweating underneath the helmets and the leather and everything.
All that leather that you wear, leather daddy.
Yeah, that's me.
Good grief.
But we only had one person drop the bike. But out of the people that were there, I enjoyed my class a lot because it was me and three other people. It was a couple who went in there so that they could avoid getting a ticket.
Nice.
Or the guy was there because he wanted to avoid getting the ticket. And his girlfriend or wife was there with him because she wanted to learn how to ride too.
Mm-hmm.
And then some dude, he was like a young kid that came in that was really overeager. He was the one who ended up dropping the bike. I mean, he was a good kid, but he was the kind who, like, as soon as he found out he was taking the course, he went out and bought the flashiest, most expensive Icon helmet he could find. And he got, like, the purple reflector lens for it. And it was all, like, cyberpunk. Like, it was, yeah, it was an interesting variety of people. It was me and my whole thing. And then, like, young cyberpunk kid and then just super white couple.
Yeah, there's a kid in there who wants to get into bikes and he's wearing, like, really expensive square-toed Harley boots and like designer black jeans and a faux leather jacket he probably got at Kohl's that looks just, I mean, you can imagine what it looks like, but he seems like a nice kid. I don't know, it's whatever.
How many people are in your class?
There were six of us, now there's five.
All right,
all I can say is, you know, I got another day, so I can't disparage anybody, because who knows, I might be the guy who drops the bike tomorrow, or, you know,
yeah,
Over throttles and hits a curb and breaks my leg. Oh, wait. That already happened.
You got that one out of the way.
Let's hope that never happens again.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a little bit about my ASMR.
Oh, God.
You know how I love ASMR.
Yes, we're both very familiar with your love for ASMR, and I love it too. I'm not putting you on blast for this.
Don't be an asshole about it.
I'm not being an asshole. I listen to ASMR all the time.
Mm-hmm. And it helps me sleep. It helps me relax and go and fall asleep. There's this one ASM artist. That's what they call them.
Yeah.
Named Jibby ASMR. And I don't her ASMR too much because she doesn't whisper quietly enough to get me into that spot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But in conjunction with some sort of sponsorship, she filmed the entirety of the B movie, the Jerry Seinfeld B movie, animated movie.
Oh, my God. I totally forgot about
that. She filmed the entire thing as an ASMR session, two hours and whatever minutes long the movie is. She did it. Not only that, but she probably got maybe 45 other ASM artists to play the different roles.
I remember that, but I totally forgot about it.
Like,
holy shit,
this is the biggest crossover since Avengers Endgame. It was insane.
Oh my God,
it's pretty cool, actually. I mean, I was following her on her Instagram story, watching her make this thing. It took at least a month to film it. I don't know how much prep time it took, but it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, no shit. I totally forgot about that. I haven't watched it. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah, it's extensive, and all my favorite ASM artists are in there.
Nice.
It's great because, you know, in the comments, in the description, she's got the cast, the cast and list. There's all sorts of different ASM artists to get into. There are dudes who get dressed up all dapper and they do stuff and their stuff is good. There's a continuum of sexiness. And obviously the continuum of sexiness is completely subjective according to the person who's watching it.
Yes.
Right. So you got those guys. For me, those guys least sexy are over here and then most sexy are on this level. Right?
Yeah.
They're from left to right. The least sexy are the guy, are the dudes, the dapper guys who do stuff. And then there's like some that are just like their whole jam is like medieval maid, you know, cleaning and washing and cleaning your room or helping you undress and stuff like that. I'm sure that's your jam, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't watched those, but I'm saying I could. That sounds like something that would be appealing to me.
Yeah. And then in the middle, there's the girl next door look, which is definitely where I am.
That's absolutely up your alley.
That is absolutely up my alley. The girl next door look. Sarah Lavender ASMR. What is her name? ASMR Darling. And even, what's her name? Shit. ASMR Glow. And those are the three that I watch a lot. And they you know, they're very cute. They're very attractive girls. They're a lot younger than me, so it's just I appreciate the types of ASMR that they do. And I'm not, you know, it's not a thing for me. But anyway, so they're in the middle of the road. And then I found where that boundary breaks into the ladies who are obviously flaunting their gifts that God gave them. With the way that they dress and the ASMR that they do. And on that side is, what is her name? Scottish Whispers.
Oh, yeah, I do like Scottish Whispers.
And then another one that I just found. I don't remember her name. God help me if I don't remember her name. She is on another level. She knows what she's doing with those videos. She knows Heathered ASMR. Heathered something or other. And it's just Heathered Effect ASMR. Heather Effects ASMR is on that other level where it's like, this is distracting. For me, it is. This is not helping me calm down. But anyway, enough about that. But I digress. Dylan, it's your birthday at the end of this week.
Is it this week? What day? Oh, it's Saturday. Yeah, I guess when this episode comes out, it'll be the end of the week. Yeah.
So I wanted to do something for Dylan, and I went ahead and spoiled it.
Yeah.
Dylan, we're going to take you to Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, I think it's really funny that he brought that up because earlier I had made a I saw a post on Instagram that I shared to my story, and it said, here, let me get it pulled up. It said, okay, Chuck E. Cheese, they claim to have out pizzaed the Hut. They said their pizza tested better than Pizza Hut's in every other way.
Yeah.
And then the next and the next panel was Chuck E. Cheese files for bankruptcy and may have to close all locations. And then it was the Elmo with the fire behind him. And it said, no one out pizzas the Hut. And I was like, that is fucking hilarious that you bring that up, because I just I just moved that to my story.
That came about because of COVID, that whole thing about, because what happened was that the Chuck E. Cheese's were like, what the fuck can we do during COVID? We can't have people in here.
Yeah, because the fucking pizza sucks. So people weren't like going out of their way for it.
They partially rebranded their pizza delivery service under a different name and were offering DoorDash pizzas. And they sold more pizzas than Pizza Hut.
Yeah.
Because obviously their pizza is shit. And, you know, they can sell it for less than a Pizza Hut pizza.
Yeah.
So that's where that came from. That's funny. I feel bad for them, I guess.
This got a little bit sadder than we expected.
No, but listen, we're going to take you to Chuck E. Cheese. We're going to take you to the Kid Casino. That's the only casino I'm interested in. You can you can keep Lucky Eagle and Cashada and the riverboats in Louisiana Shreveport. I don't give a shit about that. Take me to a Chuck E. Cheese.
Oh, my God.
This reminds me of a birthday, another birthday, a family birthday. One of my nephews, I don't remember how old he was. Maybe he was 10 or he must have been younger than that. But his birthday was like on a Thursday night. And so we were like, we're going to go to Chuck E. Cheese. So we went, and it's like, hey, do you want the family plan, the family package? It's like, well, how much is that? And they're like, oh, it's only $29.99, and you get two full pizzas and four drinks, you know, four cups for drinks, and you get like 100 tokens. We're like, fuck yeah.
That sounds tight as hell.
I've got adult money. I can afford that, because, again, the way that my parents hated us.
Yeah.
They would take us to a place called Pistol Pete's Pizza, and we would get one pizza, which is fine, because we were heavy kids. We didn't need to eat a lot of pizza. They would give us each two quarters. Just
two quarters.
Two quarters.
Jesus.
Every game at Pistol Pete's Pizza took 50 cents to play. So we got one play. Oh. You got either a minute, somewhere between a minute and a half to 2 minutes of play time at Pistol Pete's. And then there wasn't fuck all for us to do at fucking Pistol Pete's Pizza.
That is the saddest thing I've ever heard in my life, Jake.
This is how I live my life. If you're that hard up for money that you can't do those things for your kids, then you need to find yourself a better job. Fuck that church for not paying my dad enough.
I mean, fuck the church in general.
Fuck the church in general for lots of reasons, but that's my personal
Happy
reason.
Happy Easter.
That's when, so we lost our, again, we lost our goddamn minds at that birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese. We went back and got more tokens. We were giving tokens away to the kids. We were playing games. We were there for like 2 hours after we ate our pizza. And it was like I said, on Thursday night, there might have been five other people in the Chuck E. Cheese. And we did the party package where Chuck E. actually comes out and dances with it, and he has like a party hostess. You have a party hostess?
Grown ass adults.
There were like 15 of us, and at that time there were only about five kids. But we had such a good time. We got up, we were dancing with Chuck E. Cheese, we were singing the songs, we were doing the motions, but we played like we were at a casino. We played all those games, and we let the kids play all the games. We had such a good time. It's just like my entire life is all about painting over all the bad memories with good memories for my kids.
Hell yeah.
For instance, my daughter's birthday is in about a month from now, May 13th, and I'm going to buy her a Power Wheels sport bike.
Oh, hell yeah.
A pink one.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be fucking awesome.
That's going to be cool as hell.
Yeah. So it's just one of those things. But we're going to take you to Chuck E. Cheese, and we're going to spend our adult money, which God gave us, And we're gonna have ourselves a good time at the Kitty Casino.
All right. The only thing, is Chuck E. Cheese open, like, for game stuff?
It probably is. I don't know. We'll find out.
I guess we'll find out.
We'll do something.
Yeah.
What?
Chuck E. Cheese sounds like a lot of fun, but also, kids are fucking gross, and kids are in schools, and
listen,
there's COVID.
Wear your mask. Anxious. We can get a box of gloves from Harbor Freight, and we can glove it up, and we can just do it that way.
Yeah, that's what I'll do. I'm gonna double mask it and get some gloves.
Yeah, we can just glove it up.
Yeah.
The last one of the times I went with Alex to IKEA one time when I bought all this shit that I'm sitting at it right now.
Oh yeah.
My entire office, and we were walking towards the front door, and she goes, "I'm gonna wear gloves while I'm in IKEA." I was like, "Okay, you can do that." And we were wearing a mask. She goes, "Do you want to wear gloves when we're in IKEA?" And I said, "I don't know. I really hadn't really thought about it." And we're walking like three more steps, and she goes, "You sure you don't want to wear gloves when we're in IKEA?" And I said, "Give me the goddamn gloves. Just give it to me. If this is gonna make you feel any better, I'll put the gloves on." It wasn't that big of a deal. But anyway.
I mean, I get it. But yeah, that it does sound fun.
We're going to do it up. We're going to do it up crazy.
Hell yeah.
We're going to have a great time.
All righty.
All right. Dylan.
That's me.
What's your topic?
Okay. I am pretty excited for this one, given that it is our Easter special. I thought I would do something, you know, a little bit religiously tied. But I also didn't want to go super intense, because the last couple episodes I have been bringing that fucking special sauce, and it's been taxing. So this time we are talking about one of the suggestions that my father gave me, Grigori Rasputin.
Nice. Yes. The mad monk.
Yes.
It's about time. Your dad was upset at us. He called us out.
I know he did.
I was like, he straight up did. Should I respond to this?
Yeah, he had recommended it, and I was like, okay, yeah, I'll keep that one in mind, and I put it in the list of ones that I was gonna do. But the problem with this one, which is what I was working through today, is so much, like, there's a lot of really weird shit about Rasputin, but so much of his story is literally just Russian history, and it's the most boring shit in the fucking world. I fucking hate it. It's just boring. There's too much Russian history.
You know what's funny is we have a content creator friend who lives in Seguin, which is only 30 minutes away from where we are right now, and she has her own, podcast called Historical AF Podcast.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. And she does history stuff, and she does it with a comedic flair. But she has a TikTok, and I swear to Christ, every other TikTok that she posts, she mentions that she has a master's in history, or mentions and points to it on the wall. Where have a historical podcast. We get it. Enough already.
I mean, I get it. If I had a degree that was more exciting than a liberal arts associate's degree, I would probably talk about it a lot. All right, anyway, I am talking about Grigori Rasputin, and I have kind of cut out some of the boring aspects of this, because like I said, there's a lot of
Don't worry about it. Russian That's fine. History. Listen, if they were here for boring historical facts about Rasputin, if that's what you wanted, if that was your jam, go watch a History Channel thing.
Exactly.
We're here for the good shit.
We're here for the good shit, and that is what I brought.
Shit.
Grigori Rasputin was born in January 20th of 1869, which is a good number of years ago. Rasputin was the only surviving child of his mother's 8 attempts to have children.
Oof.
7 of the 8 died during childbirth.
You would think that that would be an indication that God is trying to tell you something.
God is apparently telling a lot of people a lot of things, but none of them were don't keep having children. So Rasputin was the only child to survive the harsh Siberian small town winters. And as a young boy, he claimed to be connected to heaven. He said that angels spoke to him in his dreams and gave him visions of the future.
Spoiler alert. Those were not angels.
Those were not angels. Those were mental illness.
Those were not angels, brother.
No. Let's see. He also reportedly knew things about his friends, family, and neighbors that nobody should have known. He had all this weird secret information, and nobody knows how he got it.
I'll tell you how. That's one of the signs of demonic possession or demonic influence is preternatural knowledge.
Hell yeah. But that was all the proof that they needed to believe in what he was starting to tell them. Many started believing that he was touched by God or even the second coming of Jesus. That's going to be a recurring theme.
Mm-hmm.
Adding credibility to this, he was also well known for his healing abilities as he grew up. It was reported that he was able to heal horses just by touching them, and he was able to heal people of a variety of ailments. But as you said, Jake, there were those that believed he was demonic or even the Antichrist. So basically on this spectrum, you either believe that he's the second coming of Jesus or the Antichrist. So guess just the literal one extreme or the other. But they thought that he was masquerading as a man of God to gain power and the trust of the people.
Jim Jones.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But this was backed up due to his rowdy and ungodly personality. He was known for being a thief and an alcoholic in his late teens and early 20s, and just kind of being generally frustrating and weird. But despite people's fears and confusion toward Rasputin, he was married in his mid-20s to a woman from a nearby village. He ended up having 4 children with her, but his unpleasant nature never subsided. His alcoholism continued, and he was reported as abusing his wife and children. This one is neat, because most of the time we talk about people who are the kids who get abused by the weird alcoholic dads. But now we get to talk about the weird alcoholic dad. So we're mixing it up on you, throwing a little remix in there.
Of course,
Easter special.
All the good stories have a weird alcoholic dad.
Of course they do. He also frequently cheated on his wife. Yeah.
Of course.
As well as continuing his usual antics, which eventually led him to stealing a horse. Now, let me explain why this is important.
Okay.
Okay. So, being a petty thief, an alcoholic, an adulterer, an abusive husband, they were all fine, right? But God forbid you steal a fucking horse. That was what was over the line for the village people, all right? They actively hunted him down for this so that they could punish him for being a horse thief. That was the one thing that they wanted to punish him for.
That tracks.
Right? But instead of staying there and dealing with the consequences of his actions, he ran off to a nearby monastery that belonged to the Christian Brothers. As one does.
Yeah. As one does.
And he was given refuge with them for a few months. Now, while he was with this religious sect, he fell under the tutelage of a man known as Makari, who helped convince him to turn from his devious behavior and find God as a monk.
Help me, Brother Macarena. You're my only hope.
And Rasputin agreed to become a monk and devote his life to the Lord Jesus.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Now this particular group...
I can go on and on about this.
I know.
So much.
But this particular group of monks followed a strict and bizarre path. One that involved traveling all over Siberia to spread the good word of God. And also not bathing for some fucking reason.
Ugh, gross.
So you got a bunch of stinky monks trying to convert you to God.
It's not going to work.
It's not going to work. And to add to this bizarre lifestyle, sometimes Rasputin would decide to wear shackles as he walked from village to village to inflict even more pain upon himself as atonement for his sins.
That's a whole thing. Castigation.
I know. You got this really creepy, weird, smelly, bushy-bearded monk with shackles on, walking through the wilderness of Siberia to get to small villages to say, "Hey guys, have you heard about Jesus? It's pretty cool. You guys want to talk about Jesus?"
Yeah, it looks real cool.
Yeah, because that's the fucking salesperson you need.
You and Jesus are really going places.
Oh yeah, it's looking real good for you, Hoss.
Well, sign me up.
Oh yeah. Okay, so he abandoned his family to become a monk. He just left his wife and his 4 kids alone in this weird little small Siberian village that he grew up in. And he traveled all over the countryside to a variety of villages, spreading that good word.
Mm-hmm. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. However, the life of a nomadic monk in the Siberian wilderness was not without excitement. He definitely would have run into the Clistus, a cult spinoff of the classic Roman Orthodox Church, And this particular cult was well known for attending Sunday Mass, having club meetings in the scenic and beautiful woods, speaking in tongues, singing and dancing, and purging the sin from their bodies by strangling each other until moments before passing out and using that oxygen-deprived high to conduct massive orgies in the wilderness.
I knew it was going somewhere. You got to think that if there's a cult called Clistus, that there's going to be an orgy somewhere in there.
There was an orgy everywhere in there.
I just knew it. I could feel it. I was like, this is where this is headed. I just know it. Oh, I don't know how I know it, but I know it.
Oh, you could feel it in your bones, man.
Feel it in my bones.
Oh, Jesus. Now, these weird strangulation orgies, in case you couldn't
Autoerotic
tell,
asphyxiation.
Yes.
If that's your kink, that's fine.
We're not here
as
to kink
shame. As long
as
you do it safe, you got a safe word.
Exactly.
And probably a safe hand gesture, because if you're being asphyxiated, you can't speak.
Exactly. But the influence of the Clistis will play heavily into the end of the story.
Mm.
We love to see it.
I love when that happens.
Now, you may be thinking, he's out there, he's meeting weird cults, having weird orgies, or at least watching them do weird orgies,
mm-hmm.
walking around with shackles, not smelling, being a weird little stinky man.
That makes me want to throw up. Thanks, though.
You're welcome. You may be thinking, I wonder what he's up to. What's he doing? What's his family doing? Well, eventually he did return home to his family. He went to the village to meet with his friends and family, and by the time he got there, he was almost entirely unrecognizable. If you have ever seen an image of Rasputin, you are familiar with his eyes. For one thing, they are dark, they're mm-hmm. sunken in, and intense. Like a man who's seen every war crime. They're just kind of always intensely staring off into the distance. And here's a fun fact for you that I did not know. He could dilate his eyes at will, and he often did so to make it seem like the entirety of his iris was solid black.
How did he fucking learn how to do that?
I got no fucking clue, but that's cool as shit.
I wanted to be against Rasputin, but Rasputin kind of sounds like, I mean, apart from the stinky part,
Rasputin's kind of an interesting individual.
Kind of the guy you want to, like, let's jam. Come over Saturday night. Let's get blasted and watch you do crazy, weird shit the way
yeah,
that
man.
You do.
Can you imagine how fucking crazy? Like, he was on, you know, as the story progresses, he gets, like, on some weird drugs. But, like, can you imagine somebody as, like, freaky and intense as Rasputin, like, blasted on acid?
I would just assume at any point that the guy has got to be high on something. It's like, Rasputin? I don't even know. Like,
he was definitely dipping his toe into the opium and cocaine pool for
quite
a bit.
I've never met anyone. I've never had the pleasure of meeting anybody who sounds as crazy as Rasputin. And I'm pretty sure that it would scare the bejesus out of me if I did.
It absolutely would, because this story keeps getting crazier.
Perfect.
He does not let up. But he comes back. He's got these weird, super intense eyes.
Mm-hmm.
He's got just
bushy
this rugged.
Eyebrows.
Yeah, he's got a rugged look. His hair is all greasy and matted down. He's got that big, classic, bushy, wild beard. A distinct lack of baths. And in addition to his physical changes, he also spoke more frequently about his visions from God. He said that they were more frequent and more intense than ever. One such vision was that of the Virgin Mary, who appeared in front of him and supposedly told him to go to St. Petersburg to aid the royal family.
The Romanovs.
Yes. Which?
Tsar Nicholas and his wife.
Exactly. Very
and
good.
And his family.
Now, you may be thinking, what is this weird little smelly monk man? Like, how is he going to be able to get in connection with the royal family?
Yeah. Not the kind of guy you would invite to royal court.
No, not at all. But you know what? God's got a plan for him.
That's right. The Lord works in mysterious ways.
He does. And in this particular instance, the Lord was working through his connection to Macari.
Macari, help me, brother Macarena.
Help me, brother Macarena.
Hey, Macarena.
Brother Macarena used to be the religious advisor for the Romanov royal family.
Used to be.
Used to be.
Until...
I don't know why he left, but he still had a bunch of rich and powerful connections, and they utilized these connections so that Rasputin was able to spread word throughout Russia of his bizarre abilities and gain some notoriety, with many noble Russian families and elites traveling from all across the continent to see him. Are you taking selfies over there? Aw, selfie time.
Maybe.
Send them to cute girls. Trying to lure them in with that charming smile.
That is none of your goddamn business.
Okay.
It's not my fault. I am remarkably handsome.
You can't help it.
I roll a natural 20 on charisma. Do I not?
I rolled a 4.
But I rolled a 20. So you got to play with your gifts. You're definitely a rogue.
I was thinking warlock.
Necromancer. A warlock with a necromancer specialty.
Yeah.
And I'm out here living as a bard. You've told me that before.
Mm-hmm.
God. So stupid. It's the worst.
All right. So after building up enough notoriety and respect, he made the journey to the royal family. Macarena of Time. Shit.
Macarena of Time. I love it.
That's pretty good. Anyway, Macarena. Fuck. I was trying to say his right name.
Macari.
Wrote an introductory letter to the royal family, letting them know that Rasputin was going to be coming and giving them some information on him, even though they already probably knew who he was.
Did he at least tell them to take a fucking bath?
No. I think throughout this entire thing, I don't think he takes a bath.
That's disgusting.
He's filthy. He's really gross.
So,
I mean, look at him. Look at any picture of him. He looks like he's never taken a bath.
I grew up in West Texas in the Panhandle.
And you also never took baths.
No, let me tell my fucking story.
Okay.
Listen, it was really like, it's very strange. I lived in a very small farming town until I was 5 years old called Petersburg. Tiny, tiny town. We've already talked about this in my origin story. But the thing about it is, it was like going back in time at least about 40, 50 years. Because people, within the last maybe 10 or 15 years, had just gotten running water in their houses. There were still outhouses in the backyards. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they had boarded them up so you couldn't get in them, but they still stunk.
Ew.
Like, it was really like growing up. I mean, this was the 80s, and yet it was like growing up in like the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people got running water after World War II sometime. You know? It was just so crazy. But the thing about it was that my dad was a preacher, and there was this one guy who would come to church every now and then, and he lived on his own land kind of outside of Petersburg. He had a couple of acres out there, but he was a hoarder who lived alone, and his house was full of junk, and he never showered.
Ew.
He never showered, and he stunk so bad all the time. And he would come to church. My dad would get a hold of my dad, and my dad would bring him to church, and he would sit at the front row, and you could just smell the stench coming off of him.
Oh, that's so gross.
He was always really nice to us and everything like that, but it stunk. And I remember my dad telling a story about one time that he was like, listen, come to the house and I'll help you bathe. And he bathed him, but he never bathed. And I don't think he had, I'm not sure whether, I think maybe he had, I mean, he probably had running water. I don't know. But his house was just so full of shit. I'm sure his shower or his bathtub was full of, like, you know, trash or old newspapers or bags of feces.
That makes me so uncomfortable.
Anyway, so I know what this is like. That smell. That stench. I have lived that. I have experienced that.
Now imagine smelling that and still being attracted to that. Like, still wanting to fuck it. Because Rasputin pulled women fucking constantly.
God damn it.
Right? Oh, God. He was just... Oh, boy. Give me a second to reconnect here. Got to plug myself back into the Matrix. Yeah, he's been spending some time with Macari to build up his notoriety and his reputation. And now he is making the journey to go meet up with the royal family. Now, when he gets to St. Petersburg, he meets a high-level priest and a bishop that are connected to the family.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, initially, they're put off by his appearance and his fucking odor.
Yeah.
But he managed to prove himself to them by showing off his healing abilities.
Okay.
As he was wont to do. And the men believed him to be a saint sent from God that was going to help the Romanov family. Now, after some time, he was able to start befriending people close to the Romanovs and working his way up into the family.
Working himself into the
throwing himself into the fold a little bit. And he started with the Crow sisters. Now, the two sisters had married into the Russian family, so they were not actually Russian. But they initially shared that bond of being outsiders connected with the family. And the Crow sisters were heavily tied to the occult and bizarre magical practices and eventually began teaching some of that to Rasputin. So that was his in with the family.
Got it.
From there, he eventually worked his way up the food chain until eventually the Tsarina lost her spiritual advisor. But on the spiritual advisor's deathbed, he said to the Tsarina that a new holy man would come shortly after his death and be the one to replace him. Mm-hmm. And when he finally died, the Crow sisters introduced Rasputin to her. So he was able to make his move, and he got an introduction with her and the Tsar. And with his reputation of healing, the royals sought to keep him around. Initially, they thought that he might be able to help their hemophiliac son. Now, for those who don't know, hemophilia is where you can't form blood clots. So something like a small cut can just bleed and bleed and bleed and become a serious issue.
Mm-hmm. Hemophilia.
Yes. But they did not tell Rasputin about their son's hemophilia. They wanted to keep it a secret, you know, from everybody for as long as they could.
Yeah, because then that destabilizes their hold on the people.
Yeah, you don't want to show
their monarchy.
You don't want to show weakness.
Yeah, their monarchy, because it's like, oh my God, anything could happen.
Yeah, exactly. So they were keeping that a secret, but at this point, Rasputin had begun getting a little bit closer to the Tsar and the Tsarina. And eventually, after I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks, their son fell ill and he ended up getting some sort of cut that wouldn't stop bleeding. He was bleeding out too much and he was really sick. And out of nowhere, fucking Rasputin entered the royal palace and demanded to see the boy. He said that God told him that the boy was sick and bleeding and needed his help. Mm-hmm. So they led Rasputin to the child, and Rasputin demanded to be left alone with the boy. And after a few minutes, the boy's bleeding actually subsided, and he was feeling much better, leading to the Tsarina believing in his holy abilities and making him part of the inner circle, basically. Now, one of the videos that I was getting a lot of the information on actually said that modern scientists believe that all that was going on there was he was using, you know, some basic medical practices, but also keeping away the doctors who were giving the boy penicillin, which was thinning his blood even more and making it harder for him to stop bleeding when he's already having issue. So just keeping him away from the medicine and doing his own thing was actually what helped him. But he wanted it to seem like it was a holy miracle because, you know, religion.
Exactly. Praise the Lord. Hallelujah. Thank you, Jesus. That's right. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Hell yeah. So,
hail Satan.
Hail Satan. So, there is a lot of shit that happened with this man's life, but we are not here for an in-depth history lesson on Russian history. We're here for the spooky shit.
Get to the good shit.
So, I'm going to quickly blast through some of the important points in his life before we get to the shit that I really want to talk about.
I was about to say, when are we going to get to the point where we talk about how big his penis was?
That's literally the last bullet point I have.
That's the last bullet point. You needed to have led with that. We need to talk about this man.
No, I gotta save the best for last, all right?
If anything, that proves that there is a God. And that he's not good.
No,
not that he's actually evil.
Oh, yes.
And he,
because there is...
This is like a cosmic joke.
Ooh, buddy. We got some things
I'm gonna to make this about. Mad monk, and I'm gonna give him a Dirk Diggler schlong.
Just give this man a fucking Subway footlong down there, but also make him smell so bad
that no one wants to get near him, but everybody wants
but
to get near
still
him.
Fuck him.
So weird. Oh, what so a weird.
Weird, weird man. Anyway, we're going to get through some of these quick bullet points here. Then we're going to talk about some really weird shit, and then we're going to talk about his dick. So, when he was first introduced to the Tsar and the Tsarina, and started gaining their trust a little bit more, he began frequenting the home, he began frequenting the royal palace. He encouraged the Tsar to use opiates to clear his mind and strengthen his leadership capabilities. Eventually, this led to the Tsar getting addicted to opiates that he was doing with Rasputin, and he also ended up doing the same thing with the Tsarina. She had horrible, horrible migraines, so he gave her things like opium and cocaine and different drugs.
Jesus to help fucking her, Christ.
Which is not far off from how, like, American doctors used to prescribe medicines. Like, oh, you got fucking migraines? Oh, that means you got ghosts in your coochie. Do cocaine about it.
Jesus Christ. There was a TV show, I forgot what it was called, with what's his name? Doesn't matter. The doctor, it was like turn of the century, 1900, and the doctor was addicted to cocaine. And at some point in one of the season finales, they were like, we're going to give you this new drug and it's going to cure your cocaine. And it was heroin.
Oh, Jesus, no. Oh, no. Oh, that's not helpful.
I'm having a brain fart. What's that guy's name? Keep going. Keep going. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with Rasputin. Shut the fuck up, Jake. You're not helping.
Wow.
You turn into your dad, your tangent. Hey, have you ever listened to that movie? Have you ever watched that movie? Did you watch that movie lately?
Oh, my.
Turn into my father. Keep going.
Oh, my God.
Keep going.
All right, Pop.
Give your balls a tug, Jake.
Okay, so he is getting the Tsar and the Tsarina addicted to opiates and different drugs so that they are now heavily relying on him, and he has to keep showing up. He ended up becoming close friends with their children, which I don't know why you would let a man like that around your fucking kids. But he was at the palace every week, pretty much. He was building a deep trust and bond with the royal family. The kids actually really liked him. Mm-hmm. At one point, their nanny tried to convince the Tsar and the Tsarina that Rasputin raped their kids. And the kids were like, no, he's our friend. He didn't do that shit. We don't like you. And the mom was like, I believe my kids and I trust Rasputin. And then they fucking exiled her. They exiled the nanny.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah.
Wait, they probably, now when you say they exiled her, they probably actually exiled her. They probably sent her to fucking Siberia.
They probably sent her to Siberia.
They probably sent her to the Ural Mountains to be eaten by wolves. Like, that's not just like a euphemism for, oh, they didn't let her around anymore. Or they stopped, you know, support. They unfriended her. They probably actually exiled her.
Yeah. One of the big points of, like, talking about his childhood and why it was so rough is because he was born in fucking Siberia, which was the dumping ground for, like, weird religious zealots and criminals from fucking Russia. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they almost certainly just sent her ass to Siberia and said, go deal with the fucking cultists and the tigers or whatever the fuck.
Have fun getting frostbite.
Yeah, no shit. But there, I didn't look much into that one, so I don't know if he actually did anything with the kids, but the kids all trusted him and really liked him, and every single one of them said that they hated that nanny and that nanny hated him. So seems like a good case for him here. Still, I would say not a good dude, but at least that's probably okay. Okay, so he's
always a silver lining, right?
Right, I guess. Just didn't rape kids and also has a massive dick. That's it.
Oh my God. You ever seen a naked man before? From Airplane?
Yes. Yes.
Wait, we said yes because we have seen a naked man before?
Well, I think everybody's seen a naked man before. I mean,
to be fair.
To be fair.
To be fair. We've seen our own nakedness. Keep going.
So as he's building this connection with the royal family, he also built a cult-like following in St. Petersburg, and often held potluck-style parties and religious gatherings at his apartment.
He almost sounds like a Southern Baptist there for a minute.
I know. But here's where it gets real not Southern.
We do that Baptist shit all the time.
Oh, yeah. But do you let women come from all around the, like, continent to come eat with you, speak with you, and then let him fuck their brains out?
Be a lot cooler if I did.
Be a lot cooler if you did.
Oh, my God.
Yes. So women from all over the fucking country would come over just to be part of this potluck style, you know, dinner and orgy be part of these.
That he learned from the clitoris sisters.
Yes. For some fucking reason, he's so stinky, okay? They found the, like, weird stinky man and his bizarre soulless eyes really sexy. And at random times, he would, like, for the most part, what are you doing with your mouth over there?
I'm trying not to throw up. Keep going.
For most of these dinners, he would just sit like at the table and stare forward, doing literally nothing. Like, he wouldn't talk or say anything. And then at random points, he would just start like muttering in tongues, and people would like get really close and stop talking so they could try and understand what he was saying. And for some reason, that's hot.
That says a lot about the other men that were available for sex.
I know.
In Russia.
If your choice is the weird, stinky man with the fucking soulless eyes who mutters to himself in the middle of these weird parties.
If I was a normal guy in Russia and this guy's getting more tail than me, I would want to shoot myself.
I gotta say, man, something about people like Rasputin and people like Charles Manson, it really makes me wonder, what's wrong with me?
I know.
Is it the charisma? Because I'll be honest, Rasputin does not seem like a charismatic fella.
It's the kind of women.
That's true. He does have cult people following him. They all had cult people. Yeah, that, I guess that's right. I need a cult.
And you say that, what's wrong with me? Come on. Manson's followers are still in fucking prison.
That's okay. True. Yeah. But he still somehow got married, what, twice in prison?
Oh, Jesus. Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Because people are crazy. I mean, Lyle and Aaron Menendez are both married in prison.
That's true, too. I totally forgot about the Menendez brothers.
Lots of people who are on death row. Chris Watts gets love letters all the time. Scott Peterson gets love letters all the time. I'm sure people are in love with the Unabomber.
Well, probably.
So, yeah, don't worry about it.
Fucking crazy.
Don't sweat
what,
it.
What you're saying to me is I need to be a serial killer.
Oh. No, we need to find you a normal, slightly goth girl.
We went very different directions on that. But yeah, I'm tapped out for that. This is why we make a good team. We have that dichotomy. I love that. Okay, anyway, let's see. Oh, so here was something that I really wanted to share with you because it absolutely lends credit to... The only reason he gets this much tail is because, like, these women are fucking crazy. One of the videos that I watched said that one of his followers, a woman named Olga, left her husband and her children to live in Rasputin's apartment with him. And at one point, a neighbor came in, like, the back door was open, or he'd opened the back door, and he saw Olga on her knees holding Rasputin's dick, saying, "You are Christ, and I am yours." And then he just, like, closed the back door and left and never came back.
I know. What would you say? I mean, there's nothing to be said.
No.
It's like, oh, I beg your pardon.
You just try and block that shit out as quick as you can.
And if you saw, oh my God. Yeah.
If you see a weird Russian lady holding Rasputin's giant forearm-sized dick.
Like a baby holding an apple. What the like fuck? A toddler holding an apple.
Oh my God. Jesus. Like that scene in Deadpool when he's like, I bet it looks massive in this hand when he's growing his little baby hand back. Oh God.
Oh my God. When Deadpool has to grow back his arms and legs and he walks across.
Oh my God. Yeah, he's got the little baby legs.
Oh my God. I laugh so hard. I know I say this a lot, but maybe three times in my life, I have laughed so hard that I have almost blacked out. One of them was watching Jackass the movie. The other one was listening to what is his name? God, what is wrong with me? I've turned into my dad. Kevin Hart, stand up. And then the other one was when Deadpool was shirt dicking it. That I have laughed so hard that I have almost blacked out.
I did not strike you as a Jackass fan.
This was years ago. When was the first Jackass? This was like 2001, maybe? We went and saw Jackass 3D in the movie theater and laughed our asses off. When they do the potato cannon with the dildo and it flies right at the screen in 3D. Oh my God, it's hilarious.
The first Jackass movie came out in 2002. That was 19 years ago. You're old.
Yeah, I am old. You don't need to tell me that. I recognize that I'm old. I just had to take Tylenol because I was sore from riding that motorcycle for about 4 hours. God, you don't have to convince me that I'm old. I know that I'm old.
That's true. Self-awareness is important.
I still roll a 20 in charisma.
What?
I still roll a natural 20 in charisma.
You got me there.
There you go, baby.
All right, back to Rasputin. After one of his many sexual bathhouse visits. Now, here's another thing. He often hired prostitutes and he took them to bathhouses. You would think he's going to bathhouses, he's going to get clean. But he didn't touch the fucking baths. Whoa. He rented out these private rooms and then he would just abuse the prostitutes, saying that he was freeing them from sin and then he would fuck them anyway. Right?
God, this guy's on another level. He's like from a different planet.
This dude is fucking next level shit. I don't know what dimension he is on, but he is just Baja blasted off.
Baja be that blast.
But anyway, after one of his many sexual bathhouse visits and copious amounts of drugs, Rasputin just went out into the street and then started screaming about the evil and the demons that were living inside of him.
This guy is a true sexual Tyrannosaurus.
He makes love like an eagle falling out of the sky.
This sexual Tyrannosaurus is from Predator. That's what Jesse the Body Ventura's character says at some point.
Yes,
but I love Predator. But that's just a line in a movie. This guy was living that line.
This guy was the inspiration for it. He's next level shit. But do you remember the original priest and the bishop that he met when he first came in here?
Mm-hmm. The priest, well, the bishop.
Yes. So he's out now and he's screaming about the evil and the demons that are living in him. Mm-hmm. And while he's screaming about all this nonsense, that same priest and bishop that he met earlier, whose reputations were now being harmed by Rasputin's outrageous behavior, saw that he was doing this weird shit, and they confronted him. They were like, hey, you need to chill the fuck out. Like, you are hurting all of us right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they attempted to kill him. They tried to beat him to death with a large crucifix. The fucking irony there makes me so fucking happy.
Oh, the irony.
The two holy men trying to beat the other holy man with a crucifix. Which obviously didn't work.
Blessed be the fruit.
But after this first attempt, they did not stop trying, okay? They hired a prostitute to try and kill him. After a little bit of coaxing, they figured out which prostitute would be best for it. They put her in his path, and then he took her to the bathhouse. And while he was about to start his usual, like, you know, repent for your sins bullshit, she gave it the old college try, if I've ever fucking seen it.
Let's hear it.
She stabbed him in the chest and gut over and over and over again. She just tore his shit up. And, wanting to make sure that she did her best, she reached her hand inside of the cut, one of the cuts, and pulled out some of his intestines. So they were just kind of hanging out. And then she left. But that didn't stop him.
Of course not.
Of course not.
You can't stop this man. He's unflappable.
This man is just fucking next level shit. Everybody else is out here playing checkers, and he's on four-dimensional chess.
He's on four-dimensional chess. You know, at this point, if he walks out of this bathhouse, I'd be like, okay, I mean, it's obvious he's a god.
He is.
He may not be the god.
He's one of them.
But he is a god.
He's something. Yeah, but he manages to escape the bathhouse. He goes to a hospital where they, like, stitch him up and repair him. He sends letters to the royal family letting them know what happened. And then they exile the priest and the bishop. Also send their asses to Siberia. I think they might have sent one of them. Yeah.
You are on your way to the Ural Mountains.
One of them actually left Russia dressed as a woman so nobody would be able to track where he went. And the other one, we don't really know what happened to.
Like the Bonnie King. Anyway, keep going.
And from here, the assassination attempts only got worse. It didn't slow down after this. People wanted to kill him so bad, okay? His connection with the royal family, who at this point were becoming more and more unpopular, and his part to play in the downfall of the Russian Empire.
The winds of revolution.
Yeah, blowing. And especially as they were headed into World War I. He was incredibly influential with them in making a lot of the decisions. The Russian people were not happy about this. So, shortly after Rasputin had actually healed from this first attempt on his life, December 28th of 1916, Prince Felix Yusupov and his friend Dmitry Pavlovich invited him to the Moika Royal Palace for a dinner event.
I know where this is headed.
Yes, this is the part. Now we're into the shit that I really wanted to talk about.
Here we go.
So what happened in the palace is a little bit unclear, but we have plenty of stories, some of which are probably, you know, a little exaggerated, but they're still terrifying nonetheless. When the men entered the dining area, they had offered Rasputin small cakes and teas, All of these had been laced with enough cyanide to kill nearly five men. He ate and drank for a really long time, and there was absolutely no effect. So he is just consuming cyanide after cyanide, and nothing is fucking happening. So Yusupov upped the ante and gave Rasputin wine that was laced with even more cyanide. Rasputin drank three full glasses of this wine with no effect.
Like, I like this shit. Right? Want some more?
It is tea and cakes and wine and not a fucking thing.
And it's like, again, he's a god.
Literally.
He's a dark god, but he's a god.
He is some kind of fucking extra dimensional, some sort of shit. So fed up with Rasputin's determination to stay alive, Yusupov left the room, grabbed a revolver, came back, and he shot Rasputin in the back. The bullet went clear through his chest, and Rasputin fell to the ground, and it looked like he was finally dead. Now, the men had all...
Until he started snoring, and they're like, my God, this motherfucker just blacked out. But he's still alive.
So all of the men that were there at that party, after they finally shoot Rasputin, they get their shit, they're getting ready to leave. One of the men had dressed up as Rasputin so that the bystanders outside the palace would think that they saw him leave the house.
Yeah, because he's popular.
Exactly. So they get everybody gone, and then Yusupov and Dmitri come back to the palace, and here's where it gets even more wild.
Let's do it.
When the prince finally returned to the palace, the body of Rasputin was lying in the dining hall, and suddenly, Rasputin opened his eyes, and he,
what did I just say?
He jumped up and attacked the two men, and successfully managed to fight them off until he was able to run outside into the courtyard.
Wasn't he naked?
He was mostly naked. They took most of his clothes.
If that happened, I would be so scared shitless, yeah. I would
turn the gun on myself.
Yes. There's like, no, oh my god. Option. Again, he's a dark god.
He is some kind of fucking dark god, right? Okay, but at this point, massive amounts of cyanide and a gunshot clear through his chest had not been enough to stop him. He fled out into the courtyard, stumbling and bleeding in the snow, and eventually Yusupov got his shit together after having his ass kicked by a dead man. He went outside and he shot Rasputin two more times, another one in the chest and one in the forehead at point blank range. Rasputin fell to the ground, and afterward, they wanted to make sure that there was no chance that Rasputin could come back. So they found dumbbells and they continued to beat his body with the fucking dumbbells so that he wouldn't get back up. They then scooped up his body and they threw him into a fishing hole in a frozen river that was nearby. And eventually, 2 days later, Rasputin's dead body was found floating through the river. They had managed to successfully kill him with massive amounts of cyanide and three gunshots.
Oh my god.
The amount of shit that it took to actually bring this motherfucker down. What the fuck?
Two health bars.
Two full health bars. This is that boss that you're not supposed to be able to beat
the fight against. This is a Dark Souls boss.
It 100% is.
Mm-hmm.
And now, the last bullet point. Rasputin had a fucking massive dick. We have mentioned it a little bit throughout here, but it is well known that the man was packing heat. It was 12 to 13 inches.
Like I said, he is a god.
That man is some sort of dark god.
He is a dark god.
And it doesn't end with just him having a huge dick. The story goes, and I'm not sure how true this portion of it is, but the story goes that the woman who found Rasputin's body was one of the many women that he had seduced over his time.
Mm-hmm.
The story goes that she pulled him out of the river, cut off his dick so that she could preserve it, and took it home. And then she pickled it. Now, here's the thing. Rasputin's penis is displayed at the First Russian Museum of the Erotica in St. Petersburg.
And I'm going there now.
It was sent there on June 9th of 2004.
Oof.
Yeah. And it is the main attraction in one of the country's most bizarre museums. But you can find pictures of it. It looks really gross because it's just fucking nasty and pickled. But it's his preserved massive dick that is in a Russian museum of the erotica.
Oh my god.
Yes.
Holy shit.
Yes.
Talk about the elephant man. Ooh, and it's got... no, that's gross.
Yeah, it looks really disgusting. But yeah, it is in, or as of 2011, which is when this article was from, it was part of the Russian Museum of the Erotica in St. Petersburg. Oof. Yes. And one other little point here that I actually forgot about until we started recording. Have you seen the trailer for the new Kingsman movie, The Kingsman?
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
Rasputin is in it and he looks really good.
Not only that, but Rasputin was part of Hellboy. The Guillermo del Toro Hellboy.
Yes, he was, which is also great. Fuck, I love those Hellboy movies.
Yeah, they're good.
They were all really good. But the guy who's playing Rasputin in The King's Man looks really creepy. He's doing a really good job with it. He looks like a badass. Uh-huh. I'm really excited for that. Uh-huh. But that is Grigori Rasputin. I hope you have enjoyed this topic for the Easter special.
Yeah. Now get off our backs, Dad. God.
Get off my back, Dad.
God. Giving us shit for not doing it. There, we did it. Hope you're happy.
I was saving it for Easter is the excuse I'm going
to
give you.
Yes, we were saving it for Holy Week.
Exactly. Praise we needed Jesus. To save something special to honor the Lord.
Alleluia.
Nice.
You mean to sing an actual hymn?
I've got
him in my mind.
No, I don't want
that. He lives, he lives.
All right, we're going to be right back after a short break.
He walks with me and talks with me along life's narrow way.
And now we have returned. Thank God he stopped singing.
You ask me how I know he lives.
Son of a taint.
He lives within my heart. Praise the Lord. Easter's on its way.
I hate this.
Easter's tomorrow. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
Easter's tomorrow. We used to have to go to sunrise fucking service for church. 6 a.m. church service. There'd be like 20 people there, maybe 20 people, and we'd have to be there. So stupid.
I would rather get testicular surgery again than do that.
Again. You poor thing.
Yeah.
So, one of the reasons why I'm talking about this now is because apparently my ex listens to the first part of our podcast just to snoop on me because she's got nothing else to do.
So you're saving talking about her for the middle.
Yeah. So now we're saving. Well, because she mentioned it because she got mad because of me throwing her under the bus about Snowvid. And all that bullshit. Because in case you haven't noticed with that story, if you haven't listened, if it hadn't been for my ex running out of food because she had not prepared appropriately with groceries, because they do a lot of... they do a lot of eating out and they don't have groceries all the time, or they just have their refrigerators full of leftovers all the time and they won't eat them and they end up throwing them away. If it had not been for the fact that I was worried that my kids were going to run out of food and they weren't going to have enough of this or that, I would have had the time of my life during Snowvid, because I had sufficient food here mm-hmm. and sufficient water, and I handled the whole electricity going in on and off thing. I had minimal change to my life during that time. I ate the same way that I eat every week because of the groceries that I had here. But she made it miserable. And so after that episode after we posted that episode, she just went back and forth berating me and being upset at me through text messages and Instagram messages about, why do you say these things about me in the podcast? And I was like, do you listen to the podcast? Do you want to be a part of the Insomniac Network?
I do remember that.
Would you please like and subscribe? You know we have a Patreon.
She was none too pleased, I'm sure.
She was none too pleased with that. And I was like, look, I don't mind if you listen, but please tell other people if you want to listen. You know, at least listen to the whole thing so we get credit for the number of listeners that we have.
Right.
She did not appreciate me taking that comical.
No. No, I'm sure she didn't.
So from now on, we'll just save anything that I want to say like that. Now, I mean, as a whole, I need to start talking about her anyway, but if I'm going to say anything, it'll be in the middle because she doesn't listen to the whole thing. I'm like, why don't you just listen to the whole episode? It's good stuff. She's like, it's so creepy that you listen to this, that you research all of these serial killers and these murderers and all this stuff. I'm like,
I was doing this shit before I had a podcast.
I was like, first of all, not only that, but this is in vogue right now.
Right?
It's very popular.
Yeah.
You know,
things come in
mainstream.
Waves, right?
Mainstream people listen to this stuff. It's not like fringe stuff anymore. People talk about this kind of stuff all the time, and they research it and they binge watch it all over stuff. You know, it's just weird. Anyway, but she doesn't get us. She doesn't get me, obviously, which is why we're not together anymore.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough about that.
Yeah, but I mean, also, that particular situation, that wasn't just throwing her under the bus. That was you talking about your life, like you had something going on that you were updating people on, and it was a big part of what was going on at the moment, mm-hmm. because it was talk about that or talk about sitting here in the dark. That's it. There was nothing going on.
Yeah.
There it just wasn't anything happening.
Yeah.
So it was, whatever.
It was crazy, but, and we all coped with it in different ways.
Yeah. But you know what? Oh well.
Yeah, whatever. All right. So I'll get into my topic. Bridget in Kentucky, one of our listeners, my girl Bridget, suggested this topic, and I told her that I would give her a shout out. So Bridget, hello, gorgeous. This topic is for you.
Hello. We love you.
We love you. And we're glad that you listen. All right. So I'm going to be talking about the Mantell UFO incident.
Ooh, nice.
Do you know about this one?
I know very little. So very excited.
So good. She mentioned it to me. And it kind of branches off, but you're going to love it. Okay, so there was this man named Thomas Francis Mantell, who was born in 1922 and died in 1948. He was a captain in the Air Force. He was an officer and a World War II veteran. He was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for courageous action during Operation Market Garden and an Air Medal with three oak leaf clusters for aerial achievement. Operation Market Garden was at the early stages of the United States involvement in World War II. It was a joint operation to try to liberate Holland, the Netherlands, from the Germans, mm-hmm. because they were using the Netherlands as a staging ground for manufacturing, and so they were going to try. And it was an unsuccessful thing. It lasted for about a week and a half, and they couldn't break the German line, and so they had to stop. But he was awarded medals for that. During World War II, he was a C-47 Skytrain pilot assigned to the 96th Troop Carrier Squadron, 440th Troop Carrier Group, which airdropped the 101st Airborne Division into Normandy on June the 6th, 1944, and participated in Operation Market Garden. June 6th is D-Day. Mm-hmm. At the time, he was a lieutenant, and like I said, he served with distinction and got medals while piloting a C-47 named Vulture's Delight. That's awesome.
That's cool as shit.
Mm-hmm. Which was towing a glider. His plane came under heavy anti-aircraft fire. All but one of the rudders and elevator controls were disabled, and the C-47's tail was on fire. Mantell's crew chief fought the fire with live ammunition detonating. Jesus Christ. Rather than release the glider, Mantell decided to continue with his mission. The glider was released at the correct location, and Mantell returned to base. This guy's a bad motherfucker.
Hell yeah.
This is why he got a medal. Upon inspection, the C-47 was so damaged that it appeared to be unable to fly, but he got it back. He was nicknamed Shiny by his comrades for his constant, well-scrubbed look, and he was also described as able to think fast and act quickly, obviously. So after the war, he returns to Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville in Kentucky. Here we go again. And joined the newly formed Kentucky Air National Guard on 16 February 1947. It became a P-51 Mustang pilot in the 165th Fighter Squadron.
Cool, cool.
On January 7th, 1948, the 25-year-old captain, he died in a crash of his P-51 Mustang fighter pilot near Franklin, Kentucky, after being sent in pursuit of a UFO. The event was among the most publicized early UFO incidents. Remember, UFO incidences really kicked up after the detonation of the first atomic bomb in Los Alamos, New Mexico.
Yeah.
Later investigation by the United States Air Force's Project Blue Book indicated that Mantell may have died chasing a Skyhook balloon, which in 1948 was a top-secret project that he would not have known about. Okay, you know what Skyhook is, right? They actually used it in The Dark Knight. And also in For Your Eyes Only. I think it was For Your Eyes Only in the James Bond movies. Basically, they send up this big old weather balloon up into the air, right? Mm-hmm. You like pop it. It automatically goes up. And then a plane with a hook in front of it, like a big metal hook, flies directly to the balloon and catches the tether. And you're on the ground and you've got a harness on. And the thing pulls you up into the air and rescues you.
Jesus.
So you remember the part in The Dark Knight where he goes to China to get the money launderer guy.
Yeah.
And he pulls that thing. They blast the windows, and the balloon goes up, and it's got that flashing light. And the Filipino smugglers, fly their plane, and it grabs them, and it flies them up. That's exactly what he did. So they're trying to say that maybe that's what he was chasing, right? Project Blue Book was a government research project that had two goals: to determine if UFOs were a threat to national security, and to scientifically analyze UFO-related data. By the time Project Blue Book ended, it had collected 12,618 UFO reports, and it concluded that most of them were misidentifications of natural phenomena or conventional aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what happened. Blue Book says, "Oh, it was probably a top secret Skyhook balloon." Mantell pursued this object, this UFO, in a steep climb and disregarded suggestions to level his altitude. At high altitude, this is what Blue Book decided. At the high altitude, he blacked out from a lack of oxygen, and his plane went into a downward spiral and crashed.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm. In 1956, Air Force Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, who was the first head of Project Blue Book, wrote that the Mantell crash was one of the three classic UFO cases in 1948 that would help define the UFO phenomenon in the public mind and would help convince some Air Force intelligence specialists that the UFOs were a real physical phenomenon. Ruppelt's other two classic sightings in 1948 were the Childs Whitted UFO encounter and the Gorman dogfight, which I'm going to talk about in detail because they're fucking awesome.
Hell yeah.
All right, so let's start off with the Childs Whitted UFO encounter. This happened on July of 1948. Again, remember, these three encounters happened in 1948. At 2:45 a.m., this happened in the skies near Montgomery, Alabama. Roll Tide. Two commercial pilots, Clarence S. Childs and John B. Whitted, claim to have observed a glowing object pass by their plane before it appeared to pull up into a cloud and travel out of sight. According to the Air Force officer and Project Blue Book supervisor Edward Ruppelt, the Childs Whitted sighting was one of the blah, 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 the three classics, right? Okay. In that morning, Clarence Childs, who was the chief pilot, and John Whitted, who was the co-pilot, were flying an Eastern Airlines Douglas DC-3 near Montgomery at about 5,000 feet of altitude. The night sky was clear with the moon 4 days past full shining through scattered clouds. At about 2:45 in the morning, Childs saw a dull red glow above and ahead of the aircraft. He told Whitted, "Look, here comes a new Army jet job." The object closed on their DC-3 in a matter of seconds, and both men later said that they saw the object fly past the right side of their plane at a high speed before it pulled up with a tremendous burst of flame out of its rear and zoomed into the clouds. They observed the object for a total of 10 to 15 seconds. Childs and Whitted stated that the object looked like a wingless aircraft. It seemed to have two rows of windows through which glowed a very bright light, as brilliant as a magnesium fire. Both pilots claimed the object was about 100 feet long and 25 to 30 feet in diameter, torpedo or cigar-shaped, similar to a B-29 fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
With flames coming out of its tail. Only one of the plane's passengers saw anything unusual. He reported seeing a bright streak of light that flashed by his window. Shortly after landing in Atlanta, Georgia, Childs and Whitted reported their sighting to the Air Force. They were interviewed by personnel from Project Sign, which was a precursor to Blue Book,
The
first Air Force research group assigned to investigate UFO sightings. The personnel found that the two pilots did disagree on some details. Childs claimed to have seen a lighted cockpit, long boom on the nose of the object, and the center section was transparent. Whitted did not see a cockpit or boom, and instead of the center section being transparent, he claimed to see a series of rectangular windows. That's neither here nor there. That's almost the same thing. Neither pilot had heard any sound, and although some books and articles would later claim that the plane had been hit by turbulence from the object, both pilots and the passenger who saw the streak of light stated that the plane was not affected at all by the object, which proves that it has some sort of propulsion system. Not of this world.
Yeah.
So Ruppelt, the head of Blue Book, wrote that, according to the old-timers at the Air Technical Intelligence Center, the Childs Whitted report shook them worse than the Mantell incident. This was the first time two reliable sources had been really close enough to a UFO to get a good look. Project Science personnel developed a map of the object's trajectory, which showed that it would have passed over Macon, Georgia. when an Air Force chief crew at Robins Air Force Base near Macon reported seeing an extremely bright light pass overhead at high speed on the same night as the Childs Whitted incident. It seemed to confirm that sighting. So when we talk, we always talk about how if you're going to prove anything, you have to prove it by the scientific method. Having this many witnesses helps that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It helps that. It gives it a lot more credibility than anything coming out of Project Stargate.
Especially having the pilots be as close as they were to it and, you know, all trusted Air Force people or military people.
Exactly, exactly. Ruppelt wrote, as a result of the Childs Whitted incident and earlier sightings in 1947 and 1948, Project Science personnel decided to send an estimate of the situation to the Air Force Chief of Staff. The estimate of the situation was a rather thick document with a black cover stamped across the front were the words, "Top Secret." Project Science conclusion was that the UFOs were interplanetary. Intergalactic, planetary, planetary, intergalactic, planetary. It's the Beastie Boys. Don't look at me that way. Don't come at me like that.
I didn't say anything. I don't know what you mean.
Okay, so this General Vandenberg gets into it. He throws his hat in the ring. He rejected the estimate of the situation in October of 48, citing that the report's evidence was insufficient to support its conclusions. Additionally, J. Allen Hynek from Stargate, remember? An astronomer at Ohio State University and a scientific consultant on Project Sign concluded that Childs and Whitted had actually seen a very bright meteor. It's not a meteor.
Fucking meteor.
Oh my God. Hynek noted that the flaming tail and sudden disappearance of was consistent with a brief passage by a meteor. He also stated that the large number of bright meteors had been observed by amateur astronomers on the nights of July 23rd and 24th. That doesn't make any sense. As for the rectangular windows in the cockpit that Childs and Whitted claimed to have seen on the object, Hynek wrote that it will have to be left to the psychologist to tell us whether the immediate trail of bright meteor could produce the subjective impression of a ship with lighted windows. Although a Project Sign officer disagreed with Hynek's explanation, arguing that it is obvious that this object was not a meteor and that the object should remain labeled as unidentified. Later researchers supported Hynek's conclusion. That's no moon. It's a space station. Donald Menzel, an astronomer at Harvard and a prominent UFO skeptic, noted that July 24th falls into a period of greatly increased meteor activity when the Earth is moving through the Aquarii streams. The reports for from amateur astronomers for the Southeast during that time have particular interest for the Childs Whitted incident. On the night of July 24th, an observer in Alabama counted 15 meteors in 1 hour's watching. 2 hours after the Childs Whitted sighting, a huge fireball flashed over North Carolina and Tennessee. Menzel wrote that when Childs and Whitted observed the UFO, its appearance and motion were identical with those of many other bright meteors, but the pilots, startled by the sudden apparition of a meteor, misinterpreted what they saw. There can be no doubt that Childs and Whitted misinterpreted the appearance of an unusually bright meteor, its body glowing to white and blue incandescence, shooting off flaming gases. Dylan, sometimes you shoot off flaming gases,
hey,
don't you?
Hey, now.
And vaporizing from the friction of the atmosphere. Don't cause too much friction. Menzel also recounted the experience of a pilot in 1959 who described a fiery object very similar to the one experienced by Childs and Whitted, but which the pilot eventually recognized as a brilliant meteor. Meteors do not flame up at 90 degrees from the surface. Okay, that's not how gravity works.
No, but they do if you're a UFO skeptic.
That's right. Philip Klass, another prominent UFO skeptic, agreed with the meteor explanation. Of course he did. Writing that the original Project Sign conclusion that the object was an interplanetary spacecraft was grossly in error. Although James E. McDonald, a physicist at the University of Arizona and prominent ufologist, interviewed Childs and Whitted in the 1960s and concluded that they had not seen a meteor. The United States Air Force, based on the analysis of Hynek, Menzel, and others in 1959, labeled the Childs Whitted incident as having been caused by a fireball-type meteor. I am calling bullshit on that.
Bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the first one. Let's talk about the Gorman dogfight next.
Ooh.
The Gorman dogfight was a highly publicized UFO incident that took place on October 1st of 1948 in the skies over Fargo, North Dakota.
Fargo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't you know?
Don't you know?
Don't you know? Although he was only 25 years old when the incident occurred, George F. Gorman was a veteran fighter pilot of World War II, Greatest Generation. After the war, he became the manager of a construction company. He also served as a second lieutenant in the North Dakota National Guard. On October 1st of 1948, Gorman was participating in a cross-country flight with other National Guard pilots. He was flying a P-51 Mustang, which is where the name for the Ford Mustangs come from.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. His flight arrived over Fargo at approximately 8:30 p.m. Although the other pilots decided to land at Fargo's Hector Airport, Gorman decided to take advantage of the clear, cloudless conditions and get in some night flying time, staying aloft. At around 9 o'clock that night, he flew over a stadium where a high school football game was being held. Gorman noticed a small Piper Cub plane flying some 500 feet below. Otherwise, the skies appeared clear. Shortly after he noticed the Piper Cub, Gorman saw another object to his west. When he looked for the outline of a wing or fuselage, he could see none. This contrasted with the Piper Cub, whose outline was clearly visible. They've got blinking lights and shit like that. The object appeared to be a blinking light, though. Just one blinking light.
Okay.
Okay, not like red and green on sides. Every airplane has lights that, you know, things like this.
Alternate sides. Yeah. So you can tell, like, the width.
Yeah, the port side and the starboard side have green and red. I don't know which one is which. It's not important to the moment right now. I don't have time to Google it. But you can Google it later if you want to. Let's see here. Gorman contacted the control tower at Hector Airport and asked if it had any air traffic in the area other than his P-51 and this little Piper Cub. The tower answered that it did not, and it contacted the Piper Cub pilot, Dr. A.D. Cannon. Of course he's a doctor. Mm-hmm. Of course. Nothing says white privilege like I've got my own Piper Cub. As a matter of fact, here, very close to where we are right now, very close to where I went hiking, there is a subdivision that has its own fucking airstrip.
Is there really?
Inside. Yeah, it's called Kestrel Park. It's in Spring Branch, which is only 30 minutes from where we are. It's right north of San Antonio. It has its own airstrip, and the most expensive houses in that subdivision are huge already. Big, big fucking houses. But they have huge garages, like warehouse-sized garages, barn-sized garages, for the people who have their private airplanes. And the most expensive houses there are the ones that are lining the airstrip so they can open up their garage door, taxi their own private planes onto the runway, and then fly away.
What the fuck? Mm-hmm.
Yes. 30 minutes from where we live in poverty. I'm just kidding. We don't.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So, Gorman told the tower that he was going to pursue the object to determine its identity. He moved his Mustang to full power from 350 to 400 RPM, but soon realized that the object was going too fast for him to catch in a straight run. Instead, he tried cutting the object off by turns. Gorman made a right turn and approached the object head-on at 5,000 feet. The object blew over his plane at a distance of about 500 feet. Gorman described the object as a simple ball of light, about 6 to 8 inches in diameter. He also noted later that when the object increased its speed, it stopped blinking and grew brighter. After his near collision, because 500 feet seems like a lot, but that's not a lot when you're in a plane.
Yeah, not traveling. In a plane.
After his near collision, Gorman lost sight of the object. When he saw it again, it appeared to have made a 180-degree turn and was coming at him again.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah, that's not good.
That would be terrible.
I know, right? This is bad. This is getting bad. The object then made a sudden vertical climb. Gorman followed the object in his own steep climb. At 14,000 feet, his P-51 stalled. The object was still 2,000 feet above him. The pilots are amazing to be able to, like, to be able to gauge this stuff while you're in a plane with no, like, discernible, you know, landmarks to measure, but they do it all the time.
That is fucking crazy, man.
Gorman made two further attempts to get closer to the object with no success. It seemed to make another head-on pass, but broke off before coming close to his fighter. By this point, the object had moved over Hector Airport. In the control tower, the air traffic controller viewed the object through binoculars, but could see no form or shape around the light. He was joined by Dr. Cannon and his passenger from the Piper Cub. They had landed and walked to the control tower to get a better view of the object. Gorman continued to follow the object until he was approximately 25 miles southwest of Fargo, North Dakota. Don't you know?
Don't you know?
Oh, don't you know? At 14,000 feet, he observed the light. At 11,000 feet, he then dived on the object at full power. However, the object made a vertical climb. He tried to pursue, but watched as the object passed out of visual range. At this point, he broke off the chase. It was 9:27 p.m. Garmin flew back to Hector Airport. So, he gets out of the truck. Gorman gave a sworn account of the incident to investigators. His statement was often reprinted for decades afterwards in numerous books and documentaries about UFOs. Here's what he says. I am convinced that there was a definite thought behind its maneuvers. I am further convinced that the object was governed by the laws of inertia. Because its acceleration was rapid but not immediate, and although it was able to turn fairly tight at considerable speed, it still followed a natural curve. When I attempted to turn with the object, I blacked out temporarily due to excessive speed. I am in fairly good physical condition, and I do not believe that there are many, if any, pilots who could withstand the turn and speed affected by the object and remain conscious. The object was not able to turn out-turn and outspeed my aircraft, but was able to attain a far steeper climb and was able to maintain a constant rate of climb far in excess of my aircraft. I love that.
Yeah.
Because he's basing it on his own limitations, and he's saying, okay, so the difference between this one and the Childs Whitted is that the Childs Whitted thing was flying at a distance, and then it shoots up 90 degrees from the surface. Mm-hmm. This thing sounds like an advanced terrestrial aircraft, because it's, like he says, it's following the laws of inertia, but yeah, it's moving at a speed that's higher than a P-51 Mustang, but it's still doing things. So, you know, maybe there's a human pilot in there. I don't know. It's a ball of light. Who knows what the fuck it is?
Yeah, there's no fucking telling.
I have no idea. Okay, so within a few hours, military officers from Project Sign arrived to interview Gorman, Dr. Cannon, his passenger, and the control tower personnel at Hector Airport. The officers also checked Gorman's P-51 Mustang with a Geiger counter for radiation. They found that the Mustang was measurably more radioactive than other fighters, which had not flown for several days. This was taken as evidence that Gorman had flown close to an atomic-powered object. That's fucking cool.
That's fucking crazy. Because
not only are we able to measure radioactivity off of this one, but we have a control group, because he was in a fighter wing and those guys did not witness it.
Oh, that's so cool. True.
Air Force investigators also ruled out the possibility of the lighted object being another aircraft, Canadian Vampire jet fighters, or a weather balloon. This wasn't any of those things. Their initial conclusion, according to a UFO historian, was that something remarkable had occurred to Gorman in the skies above Fargo. Here we go. Here come the skeptics. Further investigation by Project Sign personnel soon revealed flaws in the evidence. Of course it does. A plane flying high enough in Earth's atmosphere is less shielded from radiation than one at ground level. Thus, the Geiger counter readings were considered invalid evidence for stating that the lighted object was atomic powered. In addition, the Air Weather Service revealed that on October 1st, it had released a lighted weather balloon from Fargo at 8:50 p.m. By 9 p.m., the balloon would have been in an area where Gorman and the Piper Cub passengers first saw the lighted object. Project Sign's investigators also believed that the incredible movements of the object were due to Gorman's own maneuvers as he chased the lights. The object's maneuvers were an illusion brought about by the movements of Gorman's fighters. I can't shake my head strongly enough. The investigators also believed that as the weather balloon passed out of sight, Gorman had come to believe that the planet Jupiter was the UFO, and therefore he had been chasing the planet as he flew south of Fargo before giving up and returning to land. By early 1949, the Gorman case was labeled by Project Sign and its successors Project Grudge and Project Blue Book. How do we still not have a Project Pikachu? I swear to Christ. As being caused by a lighted weather balloon. It's not a weather balloon. They've been trying to pull that
everybody
shit on us
says it's
for
a
years.
Fucking weather balloon.
Get
and it's
your
never
head
a goddamn
out
weather
of
balloon.
Your ass. Jesus. The Gorman dogfight received wide national public publicity and helped fuel the wave of UFO reports in the late 40s. Although some UFO researchers, such as James E. McDonald and Donald Keyhole, which were from Stargate, I think. No. Mm-hmm. Disagreed that they sound really familiar. Disagreed with the Air Force's conclusions and continued to regard the case as unsolved. Other UFO researchers agreed with Project Sign's conclusion in the case. A UFO historian writes, unlike some Air Force would-be solutions, this one seems plausible. And that, in his opinion, after the Mantell incident, the Gorman sighting may be the most overrated UFO report in early history of the phenomenon. I don't know.
Jesus, a little harsh.
So let's go back to Mantell, who crashed his P-51. A particular historian argues that the Mantell case marked a sharp shift in both public and governmental perceptions of the UFOs. Previously, the press often treated UFO reports with a whimsical or glib attitude reserved for silly season news. But following Mantell's death, however, the fact that the person had died in an encounter with an alleged flying saucer dramatically increased public concern about the phenomenon. Now a dramatic new prospect entered thought about UFOs. They might not only be extraterrestrial, but potentially hostile as well. On January of 1948, Goodman Army Airfield at Fort Knox, Kentucky, received a report from the Highway Patrol of an unusual aerial object near Madisonville. Reports of a westbound circular object somewhere between 250 and 300 feet in diameter were received from Owensboro and Irvington. At about 1:45 p.m., Sergeant Quentin Blackwell, Quentin, that's a cool name, saw an object from his position in the control tower at Fort Knox. Two other witnesses in the tower also reported a white object in the distance. Colonel Guy Hicks, the base commander, reported an object he described as very white, about 1/4 the size of a full moon. Through binoculars, it appeared to have a red border at the bottom. It remained stationary, seemingly for 1.5 hours. Comets don't do that, and neither do weather balloons.
No, get nothing your head does that
out of your fucking ass. Observers at Clinton County Army Airfield in Ohio, Kentucky and Ohio are so close together, described the object as having the appearance of a flaming red cone trailing a gaseous green mist, and observed the object for about 35 minutes. Another observer at Lockbourne Army Airfield in Ohio noted, just before leaving, it came very near to the ground, staying down for about 10 seconds, then climbed at a very fast rate back to its original altitude of about 10,000 feet. It leveled off and disappeared into the overcast, heading 120 degrees. Its speed was greater than 500 miles per hour in level flight. Again, they're amazing that they can just, I don't know how they do these things. I mean, obviously with training.
I mean, yeah, but still, it's fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm. Four P-51 Mustangs from the Kentucky Air National Guard, one piloted by Captain Thomas F. Mantell, were already in the air and told to approach the object. Blackwell was in radio communication with the pilots throughout the event. One pilot's Mustang was low on fuel and he quickly returned to base. The other two pilots accompanied Mantell in steep pursuit of the object. They later reported that they saw an object but described it as so small and indistinct that they could not identify it. Mantell ignored suggestions that the pilots should level their altitude and try more clearly to see the object. Ruppelt notes that there was some disagreement amongst the air traffic controllers as to Mantell's words as he communicated with the tower. Some sources reported that Mantell had described the object as this, which looks metallic and of tremendous sizes, but according to Ruppelt, others disputed whether or not Mantell actually said this. Only one of Mantell's wingmen had an oxygen mask, and his oxygen was in low supply. Clements and the third pilot, Lieutenant Hammond, that was the wingman, is Clements, and the third pilot, called off their pursuit at 22,500 feet. However, Mantell continued to climb. According to the United States Air Force, once Mantell passed 25,000 feet, he blacked out from lack of oxygen, and his plane began spiraling back towards the ground.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. A witness later reported that Mantell's Mustang was in a circling descent. His plane crashed on a farm south of Franklin on Kentucky's border with Tennessee. Firemen later pulled Mantell's body from the wreckage. His seatbelt was shredded and his wristwatch had stopped at 3:18, the time of the crash. Meanwhile, by 3:50 p.m., the UFO was no longer visible to observers at Godman Airfield. The Mantell incident was reported by newspapers around the nation and received significant press attention. A number of sensational rumors were also circulated about the crash. According to UFO historian Curtis Peoples, among the rumors were claims that the flying saucer was a Soviet missile, or that it was an alien spacecraft that shot down Mantell's fighter when it got too close. Captain Mantell's body was found riddled with bullets, the body was missing, the plane had completely disintegrated in the air, and the wreckage was radioactive. All sorts of different rumors. However, no evidence has ever surfaced to substantiate any of those claims. An Air Force investigation specifically refuted some claims, such as the supposedly radioactive wreckage. Ruppelt wrote that, "I had always heard of a lot of wild speculation about the condition of Mantell's crashed P-51, so I wired for a copy of the accident report. It said that Mantell's body had not been burned, had not been disintegrated, and was not full of holes. The wreck was not radioactive, nor was it magnetized." Mantell was the first member of the Kentucky Air National Guard to die in flight. According to John Tobridge, who was a historian for the National Guard, there is a real X-Files twist to this.
Ooh.
Mantell lived almost his entire life in Louisville, but he was born in a hospital in Franklin, only a few miles from where he was killed. The Mantell crash was investigated by Project Sign, like I mentioned. One writer noted that the people on Project Sign worked fast on the Mantell incident, contemplating a flood of queries from the press as soon as they heard about the crash. They realized that they had to get a quick answer. Venus had been the target of a chase by an Air Force P-51 several weeks before, and there were similarities between this sighting and the Mantell incident. So the word Venus went out. Mantell had unfortunately been killed trying to reach the planet Venus. That's what they're trying to say. An Air Force major who was interviewed by several reporters following Mantell's crash flatly stated that it was Venus. Come on. This is an experienced pilot. He's going to know the difference between an unidentified flying object and
fucking Venus and a stationary planet.
Mm-hmm. In 1952, Ruppelt, the supervisor of Project Blue Book, spoke with J. Allen Hynek, that astronomer, and Hynek gave Project Sign this Venus explanation, mainly because Venus had been in the same place in the sky that Mantell's UFO incident was observed. However, Hynek concluded that the Venus explanation was incorrect because Venus wasn't bright enough to be seen by Mantell and the other witnesses, and because a considerable haze was present that would have further obscured the planet in the sky. Ruppelt also noted that Dr. Hynek's statement about Venus, even if visible, would have been a pinpoint of light, but that eyewitnesses' descriptions plainly detected a large object. None of the descriptions could even vaguely be called a pinpoint of light. Let me see. Somewhere in the archives of the Air Force or the Navy, there are records that will show whether or not a balloon was launched. Oh, yeah, talking about the Skyhook balloon. But nobody could ever find that. Researchers also have noted that while Mantell was an experienced pilot, he was rather new to the P-51, and this relative inexperience could have been a factor in the crash. This does not, of course, account for the identity of the UFO.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know why? Because it was a fucking UFO, and you can't just explain this bullshit away.
That's right. So that's the Mantell incident, plus the Childs Whitted incident, plus the Gorman dogfight, related, all happening in 1948, all
triple threat,
all dealing with UFOs, unidentified flying objects that could not be explained.
Fuck yeah.
That's my topic. Thanks, Bridget, for the topic. It was awesome.
Hell yeah. Thank you, Bridget. That was cool, man.
I know. It was fun.
I love UFO stories, but I hate hearing about how skeptics are always like, it was a weather balloon. It's never a fucking weather balloon. Shut up. Fucking God.
So stupid.
At least come up with something more interesting than a weather balloon. But no, it's always the same exact shit.
Always the same.
Ugh. Anyway, I'm looking at our time right now, and we're in an hour 45.
There's a lot of bullshit that we could pare down.
There is a lot of bullshit. But good episode. Chock full of information. Chock full of tangents. Lots of fun. Hell yeah. It's the day of our Lord and Savior tomorrow.
He is which risen.
Will be 2 days ago from Hallelujah, when this has come out. Hell yeah. I hope you have all enjoyed this spectacular Easter special. Remember to spend time with your families. Have some fun. Take some time to yourself. And never forget to hail Satan, my friends.
That's right. Hail Satan.
Praise be.
Praise be. Blessed be the fruit. Yes. All right, guys. Is that it?
Just a reminder, we do have Instagram. We have TikTok. We have a Patreon. I have actually uploaded something onto Patreon now.
Oh, God.
So we are starting. I have uploaded episode 1 of Too Scared to Sleep's playthrough of Doki Doki Literature Club, which me and Jake need to finish. The first couple episodes of that series are going to be a little bit weird because I didn't think about the editing, thinking about stops. But it's going to be good. If you're interested, you can join our Patreon. Episode 1 is available for either tier. We do have two. And as things go on, we're going to be uploading more videos, more content, more audio stuff onto the Patreon. It's going to be a lot of fun. Very cool. That's at Too Scared Podcast. We have Redbubble, also Too Scared Podcast.
I will never forgive you for making me play Doki Doki.
And we're not done. There is more of that to play.
That was psychologically revealing and psychologically scarring.
So if you guys would like, if you think that you would at all be interested in watching me commit psychological warfare against my friend Jake, then please subscribe to our Patreon. But yeah, you can reach out to us at a whole bunch of places if you have suggestions like Bridget's and my dad's suggestions. They're excellent. We love hearing about them. Give us your stories. Give us some suggestions. Just reach out to us if you want to be part of the network. Support us if you can. You can go do that through Anchor or through Patreon, through Redbubble, whatever makes you happy. And I love you.
Are you looking at me when you say that?
No, I'm talking to them.
Okay, good, because don't look at me when you say those things.
No, I would never.
All right, good. All right, well, if that's it, right?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. it for me.
Okay, well, from Dylan, my co-host, my name is Jake, and we hope we've left you too scared to sleep.
Before I get started, so I am a member of the Satanic Temple, in case you were unaware of this. You can join for free, but if you pay, it's like $25 or $30. Then they send you a certificate and a card that has like your name, and you get to choose which card and which certificate you want. And I'm waiting for those to come in the mail. I'm very, very excited for them. Yeah, man.
Should I join the
Satanic Temple? Yeah, you absolutely should.
Oh my God.
It's actually
you know what I should do?
It's a phenomenal organization.
Oh my God.
They're really cool.
I should sign my dad up to join the Satanic Temple.
That would be the funniest shit I've ever heard.
For his birthday?
That would be the funniest shit in the entire world. If you could show up, God, like, you could frame...
Punch me. He'd punch me in the face.
But they send you, like, a plaque, and I can show you the website later.
Oh, my God.
Or not a plaque, but, like, a certificate, and you can customize, like, which design you want on it and which design you want on the card.
That would go over, like, a turd in the punch bowl
at his birthday. That would be the funniest thing in the world.
Send up my Baptist minister dad to the Satanic Temple.
That would be really funny. Do you know his email? You can sign him up for free and he'll
get emails
from it. Of
course I know his
email.
I'm the guy who set up his email. I know his password because he can't remember it.
Yes. Oh, that's good.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, that just reminded me. I'm waiting to get my plaque and my certificate.
What do you have to do? Do you have to hail Satan every now and then? Well, no wonder we always hail Satan.
I mean, we always hail
Satan. Do you have things you need to do for them?
No. You can sign up for free.
On Saturdays, you have to go out and spread the word?
No, but there are chapters in Texas. There's one in San Antonio and in Austin that are super close.
Why are we not? This is a thing.
All right,
cool. This is awesome.
Yeah, but I've been a member for free for a long time, but I realized, because I didn't think about it, and I saw somebody on TikTok post about, like, you know, they made mention of their plaque, and I was like, oh, shit, I totally forgot I was going to buy one of those. So I went on and I did it. I think it was only like $30. And they're sending it to me, so I'm pretty hyped about that. I'll get to carry my little card with me, and it has, like, my name, and it's all, like, a fancy sort of... I put Lord Dylan Cadenhead, so I get to make use of that Scottish lordship too, bitch.
Oh, awesome.